Cohen knocked the sword out of his hand. "All right, none of that. I don't like it either," he said. "But it's just a disguise. Shouldn't mean anything to a man who once bit a bear's head off, should it?"
"Yeah, but, you know, it's not... I mean, when we went past those young ladies back there, they all giggled."
"Maybe later you can find them and make them laugh," said Cohen. "But you should have told us, Teach."
"Sorry."
"What? What's he say?" "He said you're a eunuch,"
Boy Willie bellowed in Hamish's ear.
"Yep,"
said Hamish happily. "What?"
"That's me, the one and only."
"No, he didn't mean..."
"What? Oh, never mind, it's all pretty much the same to you, Hamish."
Mr. Savaloy surveyed the wrecked gym.
"I wonder what time it is," he said.
"Ah,"
gurgled Six Beneficent Winds, happy to lighten things a little.
"Here, you know we have an amazing demon-powered device that tells you what the time is even when the sun isn't..."
"Clocks,"
said Mr. Savaloy. "We've got them in Ankh-Morpork. Only demons evaporate eventually, so now they work by..." He paused.
"Interesting. You don't have a word for it."
Shaped metal that does work?
Toothed wheels?"
The taxman looked frightened.
"Wheels with teeth?
What do you call the things that grind corn?"
"Peasants."
"Yes, but what do they grind corn with?"
"I don't know. Why should I know? Only peasants need to know that."
"Yes, I suppose that says it all, really," said Mr. Savaloy sadly.
"It's a long way off dawn," said Truckle. "Why don't we go and kill everyone in their beds?"
"No, no, no," said Mr. Savaloy. "I keep telling you, we've got to do it properly." "I could show you the treasure house," said Six Beneficent Winds helpfully.
"Never a good idea to give a monkey the key to a banana plantation," said Mr. Savaloy. "Can you think of anything else to keep them amused for an hour?"
Down in the basement, there was a man who was talking about the government at the top of his voice.
"You can't fight for a cause. A cause is just a thing."
"Then we are fighting for the peasants,"
said Butterfly. She'd backed away. Rincewind's anger was coming off him like steam.
"Oh, have you ever met them?"
"I have seen them."
"Oh, good. And what is it you want to achieve?"
"A better life for the people,"
said Butterfly coldly.
"You think you having some uprising and hanging a few people will do it? Well, I come from Ankh-Morpork, and we've had more rebellions and civil wars than you've had lukewarm duck's feet. And you know what? The rulers are still in charge. They always are."
They smiled at him in polite and nervous incomprehension.
"Look," he said, rubbing his forehead, "all those people out in the fields, the water buffalo people. If you have a revolution, it'll be all the better for them, will it?"
"Of course," said Butterfly. "They will no longer be subject to the cruel and capricious whims of the Forbidden City."
"No, that's good," said Rincewind. "So they'll sort of be in charge of themselves, will they?"
"Indeed,"
said Lotus Blossom.
"By means of the People's Committee," said Butterfly.
Rincewind pressed both hands to his head.
"My word," he said. "I don't know why, but I had this predictive flash."
They looked impressed.
"I had this sudden feeling," he went on, "that there won't be all that many water buffalo string holders on the People's Committee. In fact, I get this kind of voice telling me that a lot of the People's Committee, correct me if I'm wrong, are standing in front of me right now."
"Initially, of course," said Butterfly, "the peasants can't even read and write."
"I expect they don't even know how to farm properly," said Rincewind gloomily. "Not after doing it for only 3,000 or 4,000 years.
"We certainly believe that there are many improvements that could be made, yes," said Butterfly, "if we act collectively."
"I bet they'll be really glad when you show them," said Rincewind.
He stared glumly at the floor. He quite liked the job of a water buffalo string holder. It sounded nearly as good as the profession of castaway. He longed for the kind of life when you could really concentrate on the squishiness of the mud underfoot and make up pictures in the clouds. The kind of life where you could let your mind catch up with you and speculate for hours at a time about when your water buffalo was next going to enrich the loam. But it was probably difficult enough as it was without people trying to improve it. He wanted to say, "How can you be so nice and yet so dumb? The best thing you can do with the peasants is leave them alone. Let them get on with it. When people who can read and write start fighting on behalf of people who can't, you just end up with another kind of stupidity. If you want to help them, build a big library or something somewhere, and leave the door open." But this is Hung Hung. You can't think like that in Hung Hung. This is where people have learned to do what they're told. The Horde worked that one out. The Empire's got something worse than whips, all right. It's got obedience. Whips in the soul. They obey anyone who tells them what to do. Freedom just means being told what to do by someone different. You'll all be killed. I'm a coward, and even I know more about fights than you do. I've run away from some really good ones. "Oh, let's just get out of here," he said. He gingerly took the sword from a dead guard and held it the right way round on the second attempt. He weighed it for a second, then shook his head and threw it away. The cadre looked a lot happier. "But I'm not leading you," said Rincewind. "I'm just showing you the way. And it's the way out. Do you understand?" They stood wearing rather bruised looks, as people do who've been subject to several minutes ranting. No one spoke until Twoflower whispered,
"He often goes on like this, you know, and then he does something very brave."
Rincewind snorted. There was another dead guard at the top of the stairs. Sudden death seemed to be catching. And leaning against the wall was a bundle of swords. Tied to it was a scroll.
"The great wizard has shown us the way for only 2 minutes, and already we have extra luck," said Lotus Blossom.
"Don't touch the swords," said Rincewind.
"But supposing we see more guards, should we not resist them with every drop of our life's blood?"
said Butterfly. Rincewind looked blank. "No. Run away."
"Ah, yes," said Twoflower, "and live to fight another day. That is an Ankh Morpork saying."
Rincewind had always assumed that the purpose of running away was to be able to run away another day. "However," he said, "people don't usually find themselves mysteriously let out of prison with a bunch of weapons handily close by and all the guards out of action. Ever thought of that?"
"And with a map," said Butterfly.
Her eyes shone. She flourished the scroll. "It's a map of the way out," said Rincewind.
"No, to the Emperor's chambers. Look, it has been marked. That's what Herb used to talk about sometimes. He must be in the palace. We should assassinate the Emperor."
"More luck," said Twoflower. "But look, you know, I'm sure if we talked to him..." "Haven't you been listening? We are not going to see the Emperor," hissed Rincewind. "Does it occur to you that guards don't stab themselves? Cells don't suddenly become unlocked? You don't find swords lying around so conveniently, and you really don't find maps saying, 'This way, folks'? And anyway, you can't talk to someone who's a plate of prawn crackers short of a set meal A for two."
"No," said Butterfly, "we must make the most of this opportunity."
"There will be lots of guards."
"Well, great wizard, you will have a lot of wishing to do."
"You think I can snap my fingers like this and all the guards would drop dead? I wish they would."
"These two out here have,"
Lotus Blossom reported from the entrance to the dungeons. She was already in awe of Rincewind. Now she looked positively terrified. "Coincidence."
"Let's be serious," said Butterfly. "We have a sympathizer in the palace. Perhaps it is someone risking their lives every moment. We know some of the eunuchs are on our side."
"They've got nothing left to lose, I suppose."
"You have a better idea, great wizard?"
"Yes, back into the cells."
"What?"
"This smells wrong. Would you really kill the Emperor? I mean, really?" Butterfly hesitated.
"We've often talked about it. Two Fire Herb said that if we could assassinate the Emperor, we would light the torch of freedom."
"Yes, it'd be you burning. Look, get back in the cells. It's the safest place. I'll lock you in and scout."
"That's a very brave suggestion," said Twoflower,
"and typical of the man," he added proudly.
Butterfly gave Rincewind a look he'd come to dread.
"It is a good idea," she said, "and I will accompany you."
But it's bound to be very dangerous," said Rincewind quickly.
"No harm can possibly come to me when I am with the great wizard," said Butterfly.
"Very true, very true," said Twoflower. "No harm ever came to me, I know that."
"Besides," his daughter went on, "I have the map, and it would be dreadful if you lost your way and accidentally strayed out of the Forbidden City, wouldn't it?"
Rincewind gave in. It struck him that Twoflower's late wife must have been a remarkably intelligent woman.
"Oh, all right," he said. "But you're not to get in the way, and you're to do what I tell you, okay?"
Butterfly bowed.
"Lead on, O great wizard," she said.
"I knew it," said Truckle. "Poison."
"No, no, you don't eat it. You rub it on your body," said Mr. Savaloy. "Watch, and you get what we in civilization call clean."
Most of the horde stood waist-deep in the warm water, every man with his hands chastely wrapped around his body. Hamish had refused to relinquish his wheelchair, so only his head was above the surface.
"It's all prickly," said Cohen, "and my skin's peeling off and dissolving."
"That's not skin," said Mr. Savaloy. "Haven't any of you seen a bath before?"
"Oh, I've seen one," said Boy Willie. "I killed the mad Bishop of Pseudopolis in one. You get,
he furrowed his brow,
bubbles and stuff. And 15 naked maidens."
"What?"
"Definitely 15. Remember it well."
"That's more like it," said Caleb. "All we've got to rub is this soap stuff."
"The Emperor is ritually bathed by 22 bath women," said Six Beneficent Winds. "I could go and check with the harem eunuchs and wake them up if you like. It's probably allowable under entertaining."
The taxman was warming to his new job. He'd worked out that although the Horde, as individuals, had acquired mountains of cash in their careers as barbarian heroes, they'd lost almost all of it engaging in the other activities, he mentally catalogued these as public relations, necessary to the profession, and therefore were entitled to quite a considerable rebate. The fact that they were registered with no revenue-collecting authority anywhere, except on posters with legends like "Wanted, Dead," was entirely a secondary point. It was the principle that counted. And the interest, too, of course.
"No, no, young women, I insist," said Mr. Savaloy. "You're having a bath to get clean. Plenty of time for young women later."
"Got a date when all this is over," said Caleb a little shyly, thinking wistfully of one of the few women he'd ever had a conversation with. "She's got her own farm," she said. "I could be all right for a duck."
"I bet Teach don't want you to say that," said Boy Willie. "I bet he'd say you got to call it a waterfowl." "What?" said Mad Hamish.
Six Beneficent Winds sidled over to the teacher as the Horde experimented with the bath oil, initially by drinking it.
"I've worked out what it is you're going to steal," he said.
"Oh, yes," said Mr. Savaloy politely. He was watching Caleb, who, having had it brought home to him that he might have been adopting the wrong approach all his life, was trying to cut his nails with his sword.
"It's the legendary diamond coffin of Shiz-Yu," said Six Beneficent Winds.
"No, wrong again."
"Oh. Out of the baths, gentlemen," said the teacher. "I think, yes, you've mastered commerce, social intercourse..."
"Sorry."
"And the principles of taxation," Mr. Savaloy went on.
"Have we done that? What are they, then?" said Cohen.
"You take away almost all the money that the merchants have got," said Six Beneficent Winds, handing him a towel.
"Oh, is that it? I've been doing that for years."
"No, you've been taking away all the money," said Mr. Savaloy.
"That's where you go wrong. You kill too many of them, and the ones you don't kill, you leave too poor."
"Sounds frightfully good to me,"
said Truckle, excavating the cretaceous contents of an ear. "Poor merchants, reach us."
"No, no, no."
"No, no, no."
"Yes, that's not civilised."
"It's like with sheep,"
Six Beneficent Winds explained.
"You don't tear their skin off all in one go. You just shear them every year."
The horde looked blank.
"Hunter-gatherers," said Mr. Savaloy with a touch of hopelessness. "Wrong metaphor."
"It's the marvellous singing sword of Wong, isn't it?"
whispered Six Beneficent Winds.
"That's what you're going to steal."
"No. In fact, steal is rather the wrong word. Well, anyway, gentlemen, you might not yet be civilised, but at least you're nice and clean, and many people think this is identical. Time, I think, for action."
The horde straightened up. This was back in the area they understood.
"To the throne room," said Genghis Cohen.
Six Beneficent Winds wasn't that fast on the uptake, but at last he put two and two together.
"It's the Emperor,"
he said, and raised his hand to his mouth in horror, tinged with evil delight.
"You're going to kidnap him."
Diamonds glittered when Cohen grinned. There were two dead guards in the corridor leading to the private imperial apartments.
"Look, how come you were all taken alive?" whispered Rincewind. "The guards I saw had big swords. How come you're not dead?"
"I suppose they planned to torture us," said Butterfly. "We did injure 10 of them."
"Huh? Pasted posters on them, did you? Sang revolutionary songs until they gave in? Listen, someone wanted you alive."
The floors sang in the darkness. Every footstep produced a chorus of squeaks and groans, just like the floorboards at the university. But you didn't expect that sort of thing in a nice, shiny palace like this.
"They're called nightingale floors," said Butterfly. "The carpenters put little metal collars around the nails so that no one can creep up unawares."
Rincewind looked down at the corpses. Neither man had drawn his sword. He leaned his weight on his left foot. The floor squeaked. Then he leaned on his right foot. The floor groaned.
"This isn't right, then," he whispered. "You can't creep up on someone on a floor like this. So someone they knew killed those guards. Let's get out of here."
"We go on," said Butterfly firmly.
"It's a trap. Someone's using you to do their dirty work." She shrugged.
"Turn left by the big jade statue."
It was 4 in the morning, an hour before dawn. There were guards in the official staterooms, but not very many. After all, this was well inside the Forbidden City with its high walls and small gates. It wasn't as though anything was going to happen. It needed a special type of mind to stand guard over some empty rooms all night. One big river had such a mind, orbiting gently within the otherwise blissful emptiness of his skull. They'd happily called him One Big River because he was the same size and moved at the same speed as the Hung. Everyone had expected him to become a sumo wrestler, but he'd failed the intelligence test because he hadn't eaten the table. It was impossible for him to get bored. He just didn't have the imagination. But since the visor of his huge helmet registered a permanent expression of metal rage, he'd in any case cultivated the art of going to sleep on his feet. He was dozing happily now, aware only of an occasional squeaking, like that of a very cautious mouse. The helmet's visor swung up. A voice said,
"Would you rather die than betray your emperor?"
A second voice said,
"This is not a trick question."
One Big River blinked, and then turned his gaze downwards. An apparition in a squeaky-wheeled wheelchair had a very large sword pointing at exactly that inconvenient place where his upper armour didn't quite meet his lower armour. A third voice said,
"I should add that the last 29 people who answered wrong are dried shredded fish. Dead.
A fourth voice said,
"And we're not eunuchs."
One Big River rumbled with the effort of thought.
"I think I rather live," he said.
A man with diamonds where his teeth should have been gave him a comradely pat on the shoulder.
"Good man," he said. "Join the Horde. We could use a man like you, maybe as a siege weapon."
"Who you?"
he said.
"This is Genghis Cohen," said Mr. Savaloy, "doer of mighty deeds, slayer of dragons, ravager of cities. He once bought an apple."
No one laughed. Mr. Savaloy had found that the Horde had no concept whatsoever of sarcasm. Probably no one had ever tried it on them. One Big River had been raised to do what he was told. Everyone had told him what to do, all through his life. He fell in behind the man with diamond teeth because he was the sort of man you followed when he said follow.
"But, you know, there are tens of thousands of men who would die rather than betray their emperor,"
whispered Six Beneficent Winds as they filed through the corridors.
"Well, I hope so."
"Some of them will be on guard around the Forbidden City. We've avoided them, but they're still here. We have to deal with them eventually."
"Oh, good," said Cohen.
"Bad," said Mr. Savaloy. "That business with the ninjas was just high spirits."
"High spirits," murmured Six Beneficent Winds.
"But you don't want a big fight out in the open. It'll get messy." Cohen walked over to the nearest wall, which had a gorgeous pattern of peacocks, and took out his knife.
"Paper," he said. "Bloody paper. Paper walls."
He poked his head through. There was a shrill whimper.
"Oh, sorry, ma'am. Official wall inspection."
He extracted his head, grinning.
"But you can't go through walls," said Six Beneficent Winds.
"Why not?"
"Well, they're the walls. What would happen if everyone walked through the walls? What do you think doors are for?"
"I think they're for other people," said Cohen.
"Which way's that throne room?"
"What?"
said Mad Hamish.
"This is lateral thinking," explained Mr. Savaloy as they followed him. "Genghis is quite good at a certain kind of lateral thinking."
"What a lateral?"
"It's a kind of muscle, I believe."
"Thinking with your muscles? Yes, I see," said Six Beneficent Winds.
Rincewind sidled into a space between the wall and a statue of a rather jolly dog with its tongue hanging out.
"What now?" said Butterfly.
"How big's the Red Army?"
"We number many thousands," said Butterfly defiantly.
"In Hung Hung?"
"Oh, no. There is a cadre in every city."
"You know that, do you? You've met them?"
"That would be dangerous. Only Two Fire Herb knows how to contact them."
"Fancy that.
Well, do you know what I think? I think someone wants a revolution. And you're all so damn respectful and polite he's having his work cut out trying to organise one. But once you've got rebels, you can do anything."
"That can't be true."
"The rebels in other cities, they do great revolutionary deeds, do they?"
"We hear reports all the time."
"From our friend Herb?"
Butterfly frowned.
"Yes."
"You're thinking, aren't you?" said Rincewind. "The old brain cells are finally banging together, yes? Good. Have I convinced you?"
"I don't know."
"Now, let's go back."
"No. Now I've got to find out if what you're suggesting is true."
"Dying to find out, eh? Good grief, you people make me so angry. Look, watch this."
Rincewind strode to the end of the corridor. There was a pair of wide doors, flanked by a pair of jade dragons. He flung them back. The room inside was low-ceilinged but large. In the centre, under a canopy, was a bed. It was hard to make out the figure lying there, but it had that certain stillness that suggests the kind of sleep from which there is unlikely to be any kind of awakening.
"You see," he said, "he's been killed already."
A dozen soldiers were staring at Rincewind in amazement. Behind him he heard the creaking of the floor, and then some whooshing sounds followed by a noise like wet leather being hit against a rock. Rincewind looked at the nearest soldier. The man was holding a sword. One drop of blood coursed down the blade and, with a brief pause for dramatic effect, fell on the floor. Rincewind looked up and raised his hat.
"I do beg your pardon," he said brightly. "Isn't this room 3B?
And ran for it. The floor screamed under him, and behind him someone screamed Rincewind's nickname, which was "Don't Let Him Get Away."
"Let me get away," Rincewind prayed. "Oh, please, let me get away." He slipped as he turned the corner, skidded through a paper wall, and landed in an ornamental fish pond. But Rincewind, in full flight, had cat-like, even messianic, abilities. The water barely rippled under his feet as he bounced off the surface and headed away. Another wall erupted, and he was in what was possibly the same corridor. Behind him, someone landed heavily on a valuable koi. Rincewind shot forward again. From. That was the most important factor in any mindless escape. You were always running from. Two could look after itself. He cleared a long flight of shallow stone steps, rolled upright at the bottom, and set off at random along another corridor. His legs had sorted themselves out now. First, the mad, wild dash to get you out of immediate danger, and then the good, solid strides to put as much distance as possible between you and it. That was the trick. History told of a runner who'd run 40 miles after a battle to report its successful outcome to those at home. He was traditionally regarded as the greatest runner of all time. But if he'd been reporting news of an impending battle, he'd have been overtaken by Rincewind. And yet, someone was gaining. A knife poked through the wall of the throne room and cut a hole large enough to afford space for an upright man or one wheelchair. There was muttering from the horde.
"Bruce the Hoon never went in the back way."
"Shut up."
"Never one for back gates, Bruce the Hoon."
"Shut up."
"When Bruce the Hoon attacked Al Carly, he did it right at the main guard tower with 1,000 screaming men on very small horses."
"Yeah, but last I saw of Bruce the Hoon, his head was on a spike."
"All right, I'll grant you that, but at least it was over the main gate. I mean, at least he got in."
"His head did."
"Oh, my."
Mr. Savaloy was gratified. The room they'd stepped into was enough to silence the horde, if only briefly. It was large, of course, but that hadn't been its only purpose. One Sun Mirror, as he welded the tribes and countries and little island nations together, had wanted a room built which said to chieftains and ambassadors, "This is the biggest space you've ever been in. It is more splendid than anything you could ever imagine, and we've got a lot more rooms like this." He had wanted it to be impressive. He had very clearly wanted it to intimidate mere barbarians so much that they'd give in there and then. "Let there be huge statues," he'd said, "and vast decorative hangings. Let there be pillars and carvings. Let the visitor be silenced by the sheer magnificence. Let it say to him, 'This is civilization, and you can join it or die. Now drop to your knees or be shortened some other way.'" The horde gave it the benefit of their inspection. Finally, Truckle said,
"It's all right, I suppose, but not a patch on our chieftain's longhouse back in Skund. It hasn't even got a fire in the middle of the floor, look."
"It's gaudy, to my mind."
"What?"
"Typically foreign."
"I'd do away with most of these and get some decent straw on the floor, few shields round the walls."
"What? Mind you, get in a few hundred tables and you could have a hell of a carouse in here."
Cohen walked across the huge expanse towards the throne, which was under a vast ornamental canopy.
"It's got an umbrella over it, look."
"Probably the roof leaks, you can't trust tiles. A good reed thatch'll give you 40 years bone dry."
The throne was lacquered wood, but with many precious gems set in it. Cohen sat down.
"Is this it?"
he said.
"We've done it, Teach." "Yes, of course, now you have to get away with it," said Mr. Savaloy. "I'm sorry," said Six Beneficent Winds. "What have you done?"
"You know that thing we were here to steal," said the teacher.
"Yes?" "It's the Empire,"